Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Absolutely. And, you know, part of that, having that fun atmosphere and this just attracting people, not only, you know, folks that are coming in to taste, but people that want to work here, you know, people that work down in the tasting room, they really enjoy what they do. And it comes through when people come and taste, because they see like, hey, this is a fun place. And these guys love working here because they just, you know, they love the music. They understand that the wines are high quality. And I think that that's another part of it. It's one of the more rewarding things about what I get to do is travel the country and sell wine. But every once in a while, you'll meet somebody who, oh, I've been to your winery, or I was there last year. And they'll always remember who hosted them. You know, they'll be like, yeah, Tom took care of us, or Ricardo took care of us. And like, it was just the greatest day. And like, oh my gosh, we're coming back and we can't wait to see. And it's like, they remember, you know, their host, because they just got that experience, you know.
That's great.
And it's fantastic. And those guys deserve it. You know, they're really champions of our brand. And a lot of our guys have been with us for a while now. So we're really fortunate.
There's
about
definitely
that.
Definitely sustainability going on. And we're not talking.
Yeah, exactly.
In terms of the
chart,
we're talking about the human capital.
Absolutely.
So we have this two beautiful wines in our glass. We have the 17 Savoy from Anderson Valley.
Right.
Boy,
so,
am I excited to try it.
Shifting to red wines. We're going to start with the Savoy Vineyard Pinot Noir. So, and the 2017. So this is a fun, you know, we're hanging out, let's taste some that's not available yet. The 2016 is currently in the marketplace, but I wanted to taste the 17 because it is brand new, and I just saw it down in the storage and I was like, yeah, I haven't tasted that yet, so let's give that a whirl. And truly, I mean, with our single vineyard wines, certainly with Savoy, I love these wines in their youth. I love when they just have all of that like freshness and just aromatic intensity that eventually settles into a different form. But this is all about Savoy Vineyard.
Oh my God, I had goosebumps when I first smelled it.
Yeah.
When you said intensity, that's exactly how it hit me. It's like, oh my God, there's a whole library. It's not just a book in this glass happening. For young wine to show with such, it's Pork would probably say tour de force.
Sure. And I think that's, and again, you know, that's, you know, we're talking about Pinot Noir here, which isn't always a powerful wine, but this is, you know, this is Anderson Valley. And I think that's what I've grown to appreciate about the Anderson Valley, is that it is similar to Napa in that you have the warm days and the cool nights. It's not as drastic. It's not as hot as Napa gets. And the period of warmth throughout the day isn't as long. That cool air flows in a lot sooner than it would in Napa. But that range in temperature is what expresses itself in these wines. You get the intensity of fruit, you get the weight on the palate, but you also have this refreshing quality, and you also have that herbaceousness and these subtle earthy elements that tell you it's Pinot Noir, right? And that's really what I think our vision is to highlight in the Fell wines, is that true Anderson Valley, again, that energy that the Anderson Valley has, is what we're not trying to shy away from that.
It has a hedonic quality. So I'm tasting so much fruit, black, blue, red, you name it. But yet it's balanced so well with the structure, the architecture, the backbone of acidity and the spice, the earthy qualities. Like I said, there's so much in this wine, and it's so young.
Yeah.
It's almost counterintuitive.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what it would be like a year or two from now, even, let alone down the road.
It's going to be fun to watch these wines again as we just learn more about our vineyard and how to make great wine from it. It's going to be fun to watch them evolve. I mean, I've tasted 2012s recently, and they're beautiful. It's a different flavor profile, it's more evolved, but these wines have great shelf life and cellar potential. There's no doubt about it. But me personally, I really do enjoy them like young like this. I'm not opposed to it. I feel like, you know, for California, that again, that like youthful pop of energy, I'm attracted to that when it comes to these wines.
Yes, it's uncommon level of energy, concentration, complexity, the finish. I mean, I can count probably to a good minute.
Yeah. And there's always that little hint of, it's almost like eucalyptus or like spearmint.
I was wondering what that was.
Yeah, that's a signature element of the Savoy vineyard. There's this wild weed that grows throughout the vineyard called pennyroyal. And if you walk through the vineyard, you can kind of get these wafts of spearmint, like this minty quality. And if you actually, handle the squish it between your fingers, and you can really smell that quality. And so, it's that sense of place that not only comes through in our version of Savoy, but, Rey Couteau or Litera or Fela or like Pei, any of the producers that make wine from there, there's always that element, maybe more pronounced than others, maybe not, but there's always that signature sort of feel to it.
A little pop of freshness that's so unexpected.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have identified it as mint necessarily because it's so counterintuitive. Mm-hmm. If I was tasting blind, maybe.
Yeah.
But when you said it, it's like, oh my God, that's it. I'm not crazy.
Yeah.
I'm not imagining.
Exactly.
That is so fun. And the wine to have so much substantively and yet to be so elegant and light on its feet, that's what blows my mind, mm-hmm. is that. It's a big, broad shoulders, significant mm-hmm. wine, and yet it's not, it's not heavy. It's not in any way imposing.
Yeah. And that's why, a lot of the time I'm out showing these wines, I'm confident with them because I know that a lot of people like really, they like bold flavors in Pinot Noir, and that is where I think our niche is with these wines. They're bold, but they're not massive and cloying and awkward, they're bold, but they're still subtle, and they still taste like Pinot Noir.
Oh,
for your
so.
For your traditionalist that likes the more Burgundian elements, I would say, put this in the cellar for a few years and let it develop all those secondary and tertiary flavors and aromas. Like, that's going to come. But for the consumer that likes intensity, you can drink them now.
That is the coolest part of all, because, what would you put maturity gates for this wine for?
It's hard to know exactly because we just don't have the track record. But, going back, like I say, and tasting the 2012, I thought it was beautiful, and that was just recent. I had that. So, we're talking about a wine that's been in bottle we're 7 years on vintage now. So, Pinot Noir at that age doesn't always show that well. But I enjoyed it. It definitely was showing more of those aged elements. And again, it comes down to your personal tastes.
Absolutely.
I like them a little bit more fresh, that fruit quality that's currently being exhibited in this wine is just, I just love it.
Like,
crazy. I just absolutely love it. So that does evolve, and it does turn into something beautiful, but I'm just being completely
dark
honest.
Italian
I love
plum
this right
that
now.
I'm just, oh my God, I just want to be all in it. I just so appreciate when the wine could be drunk on release and mm-hmm. laid down. Some wines, it's a requirement.
Right.
You have to lay it down in order to enjoy it. And I've always mm-hmm. felt a little resentful of that type of wine, so uh-huh. just a personal preference.
Sure.
So I have a deep love for those that honor the palate on release. I think the wine should be delicious. It uh-huh. should be craveable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree, and I think that's where California, like a lot of wine that gets made in California, I think that's the advantage we have, and why, be afraid to talk about that. It's okay that it's great to be drank young, and it's okay that it can be aged for years and years and still mm-hmm. be delicious. Is this Savoy vineyard going to outperform something from the old world in 30 years from now? I don't know. We'd have to do that tasting to really ultimately see, but that's okay if it doesn't, it's okay. And I think that the more people that accept that and not necessarily try to make something that, that speaks too much to their philosophy one way or another. I think just do what the place tells you to do,
Exactly.
And that's what Anderson Valley is.
Be who you are, embrace yourself. It's always been a funny thing for me because people that are able to collect a fair amount of wine, by the time you get to that station in life, usually you're a bit older. Mm-hmm. And then you're buying wines that would take 20 years to unravel. Mm-hmm. Why would you drink them?
Yeah.
So it's nice not to have to be forced into this position. Mm-hmm. And you're so correct about embracing the place, about not comparing yourself to something else.
Mm-hmm.
As fun as it is to do comparative tastings, in general, I prefer it to be in a panel setting, in other words, mm-hmm. peers, something that has a common thread, mm-hmm. not just in terms of varietal, but geography as well,
yeah.
and vintages, because otherwise it's a bit of an apple and pineapple comparison.
Yeah.
They're both relevant, yeah. but in different ways.
Yeah.
So as much as I hate to leave the Pinot, and I
yeah,
do
mean, we can come back to it.
I'm not leaving you. I'm just, it's uh-huh. a temporary, I'm very excited to try the, so this is a 2015, and
yep.
As we mentioned earlier, a short vintage. So how many cases of the Moon Fantasy do you have?
Moon Fantasy 2015, we probably made, I'm going to guess, around 1,000 cases.
Okay, and so it's very limited.
And this will fluctuate, you know. I think we've been growing the production of this wine slightly because we have more fruit in our vineyard, and
yeah.
our vineyards are maturing and becoming more and more high quality, so we
yeah.
can actually make a little bit more of this these days. But I want to guess around 1,000 cases. I don't have the tech sheet in front
no,
of me.
No,
but
no, no. Just,
that's
just
typically where we land around with this wine.
Yeah.
yeah, and 15 was a short vintage, but high quality.
Yes.
So it's a great thing to point out because, again, I talked about three wines we make. We make the Stag's Leap District Cabernet, mm-hmm. which is kind of the whole property. We make then the Rock Block series, which is what Moon Fantasy is. It falls under that element. And then we have Poetry, which is the Hillside. So in 15, when we had really small yields and a short vintage, the wine that suffered the most was the Stag's Leap District Cab.
Okay.
We had such high quality juice that year that
yeah.
the sort of the higher end wines, the quantities on those were fine because we had more than enough great quality wine to be able to craft those. But since we had less wine, it was the one that we make the most of that suffered. So typically our Stag's Leap District Cab is a, you know, a 6,000 to 7,000 case production. And in 2015, it was 4,200 cases. So it was tiny that year, you know, still delicious. It's just,
yeah.
it really showed how small that vintage was for everybody here. So I love 2015. I think that this wine, it's just one of those vintages that's going to drink well for a long time. I mean, it's big, it's broad-shouldered and muscular, but, you know, if you like Cabernet, this is like, you know, we're talking about Stag's Leap District and we're talking about great vineyards and a great team. And 15, I think, is a great vintage.
In the nose, again, talk about intensity. There's this cassis. I know people
yeah.
sometimes challenge it. It's like, yes, it's black currant.
Mm-hmm.
And if you tasted or smelled it at any point, like in real life, there's a lot of it in there.
Mm-hmm.
But also really interesting pepper quality.
Mm-hmm.
Like red pepper, green pepper,
yep.
this kind of capsicum.
Mm-hmm.
Hugely, like the nose is just so amplified to me.
Yeah. That's a great word, amplified.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this wine, it truly is like, you know, I talked about Stag's Leap Cab and Poetry, and, you know, those wines are more, I want to say they're like more traditional and a little bit more like, you know, the buzzword is old Napa, and it's not that, okay, we're not picking really, it's not that or anything, it's just that like, they are a little bit more like traditional Napa. This one is a little bit more modern Napa. This one's
mm-hmm.
a bit more like, you know, that's why we have the whole rock and roll vibe, and the tagline on the back of the bottle says these go to 11. So it's like, you know, it's just one more,
yeah.
it goes one more. And that's what's reflected in this wine. You know, it's more of like, all right, what are the vineyards this year that are just really like opulent and just really exciting? And that's what this bottling always showcases. So that's what I think makes it fun, is that it has that sort of, it's like Cabernet with attitude, you know.
It is such a serious wine in some respects. Oh my god, look at the legs, like the glycerin-y quality.
Yeah.
It's unctuous, and it's that way in the palate, it's not just
mm-hmm.
the glass. But it has that modern feel to it, like you described it. It has the energy, it has
mm-hmm.
the, again, using your language, the attitude. It's the perfect
uh-huh.
word to describe it. It's so tightly wound in some ways. There's
mm-hmm.
that core in mid-palate. That's unmistakable,
mm-hmm.
undeniable. It's there. And the finish, to me, reveals the age-worthiness more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it smells intense, it tastes intense, not overbearing,
mm-hmm.
but definitely very, very present.
I think the number one thing I love about this wine is it tastes like our vineyard. It tastes like you know, and it's, I don't go around, you know, licking rocks or anything like that that they talk about, but, you know, walking, like going back in the story, you know, walking those vineyard rows and counting clusters and being on that poetry hillside at, you know, 2 p.m. and it's hot and all the, you know, rocks are baking and just the air that you smell. Wow. It's like you can almost, for me, I can taste that in this wine. I can taste that, like, that volcanic, that baked volcanic rock.
Wow.
Like that quality.
That's really cool.
It's really evident in our Stag's Leap wines, you know, and certainly this one because it is so specific to our vineyard.
That must be so rewarding, just what you described right now, knowing that that quality translated.
Mm-hmm.
Like what you were saying about Anderson Valley and what you're saying about Napa, and just saying, hey, this is true to place. This is that sense of place. It's not just marketing term.
Yeah. Well, you know, and part of it is, it could be just, you know, how I remember the vineyard and yeah. the influences I had. And, you know, going back to Savoy, I always get this, like, you know, forest floor. It's not, you know,
yeah.
like Burgundy earthiness, but it's like damp forest because yeah. literally right across the street from the Savoy vineyard is the Hendy Woods. And you go walk through there and it's like, you know, pine and decaying and it's, you know, moist. You have moss and just that yeah. whole, like, riverbed quality, like I get that in the Savoy, and it probably is because I've walked through those woods, you know, and whether or not it translates, I mean, I just can't deny that I get those elements in these wines. And, you know, I encourage people to come and check it out, go for a walk through the Hendy Woods. It's beautiful yeah. next time you're in the Anderson Valley. But
wines are about yeah. context, aren't they?
Yeah.
Context in terms of how they were raised and how they were made, and also the context that you're consuming them in.
Absolutely.
But, you know, on the marketing side, which is what you do, when you talk about it, I mean, you've already shared so much great intel. Mm-hmm. What other things do you like to highlight for your trade consumers, customers, I guess, mm-hmm. and just anybody that you're talking to about your wines? Is there anything we haven't covered?
You know, I think we've covered a lot of the basic elements. I mean, the ultimate thing I always try to drive home is just a philosophy of not chasing one thing or another.
Yep.
I think, you know, we did touch on that, but I think it's really important nowadays because in the media and in wine circles, you have so much discussion on one end or the other and so much, like, rejection of one thing or not. And I think a lot of the time, the wineries that are just kind of in the middle ground, right? Like they're not forcing, you know, ripeness to the extreme, and they're not mm-hmm. picking extremely early. There's so many wineries here in Napa and in California in general that are just riding this middle ground, and I think that's where the most exciting wines exist. And so for me, selling to a lot of trade people and restaurants and mm-hmm. you know, people that are always looking for, well, okay, what's hot, what's going to sell, that's what I'm always talking about. I'm like, look, I know that it may not be the super in vogue thing right now, but, you know, this is a product of a philosophy that's going to live for a long time. It's not trendy, and maybe it will hit some trend at some point, right? Maybe, you know, rock and roll wine will be like this big
yeah.
trend. And so I don't know, but it's the winemaking. It's the light hand, as you mentioned. It's all of those things, and it's the family vision behind it of maintaining that, you know, and not trying to, you know, oh, we want to blow up production of our Sauvignon Blanc to 300,000 cases and make a bunch of, you know, money. I mean, you know, if it was that in demand and that successful, I guess, well, that might be kind of interesting, but mm-hmm. our philosophy is just to make really good wine and stay true to where we are and just to develop that reputation
yeah.
so that in the long run, people can always come back to your wine and appreciate it for what it is and appreciate that if they pull a 2015 in the year 2035, they're going to be tasting 2015. They're not going to be tasting something that we tried to make taste like 2010 or, you know,
yeah.
it tastes like 2015. So I think I could probably ramble on and on about all the different marketing and, you know, terms I use and things and sort of messages I try to get across, but it's all of those things, you know, it's all those things. And I think just sticking to your vision and carrying that forward and teaching that to the next generation, I think that's how you become successful in the wine world. It's all about long-term vision.
That's actually really a huge statement. I just want to pause on that for a moment, that you have a long-term strategy and you adhered to it. You didn't deviate. And there's a lot of temptations, especially when things become challenging. Mm-hmm. One of the challenges that is discussed a whole lot is the millennial audience.
Mm-hmm.
Wine consumers are changing as mm-hmm. we speak. People that bought wine, you know, let's be honest, were very influenced by scores
mm-hmm.
that bought it in quantity.
Yep.
I think millennial consumer is more about experiential part of it. It's more about the story.
Mm-hmm.
They're really not interested in packing, even if they can afford it, which is a separate discussion, but
sure.
let's just say that they're in a position to buy. They're buying patterns that are more diverse. They're not buying, you know, several cases of the same wine.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's lots of other distractions nowadays
yep.
with craft beverages of all sorts. So
yeah.
how do you tackle that? What are your thoughts on that?
It's a great subject and a really, you know, it can be a really long one for sure. I agree. I think it's kind of, it almost makes me a little sad sometimes when I think about how I collect wine.
Yeah.
Like I, to your point, I buy a ball this, ball that, maybe two bottles of that. You know, my cellar is probably, you know, I have a 100-bottle wine fridge and it's probably, you know, 70 different producers just because
nice.
I only have ones and twos of everything. But I look back at how my dad collected wine,
yeah.
you know, and he collected a lot of Bordeaux, but it was at a time when it was a lot more affordable,
sure.
you know, it just was and more accessible. And he'd buy a case of something, you know, and then he'd buy a case of something else. And nowadays, he still has some of those wines and we'll drink them together from time to time. And they're magical. It's so cool to be able to share that. And he's like, oh, I remember buying that wine when I was on a business trip driving through Saskatchewan or something,
yeah.
you know, which is like, wow, like, or there might be a sticker on the bottle that says like, you know, $15 at the, you know, the LCBO or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like remarkable that he collected wine like that and stored it properly and held onto it for so long. And that is a challenge for the next generation of wine consumers. And I don't necessarily have the answer. I don't know how people are, if they're gonna change their ability or their preferences. I will say that I think for me, as I get older, and I mean, I wouldn't say I'm like the typical millennial because I've been drinking wine a really long time and I've been around it a really long time, but what I found with myself is all the exploration I've done, I've almost come back from that now. And now I'm more like, okay, if I want to drink Italian, I know a handful of producers that I know and love, and that's what I want to buy, you
mm-hmm.
know? And same thing, you can apply that to, you know, Spain, to France, even here in California, there's like things that I want to stick to and collect and enjoy. And I think that's potentially part of the future is really developing that relationship
mm-hmm.
and that loyalty is there. And I know a lot of people, oh, millennials aren't loyal. I think it's there. It's
mm-hmm.
just, it's going to take a longer time for them to become loyal. It's not just 3 99-point scores in a row. It's more than that. It's getting to know them and going to events and tasting with them and telling them the stories of the wine. And then when they come to Napa, encouraging them to visit and then showing them the property and just engaging them on a more, you know, experiential level so that there's a deeper appreciation for what we do. I think that's there. I also just think, you know, millennials right now, a lot of them aren't in that, they're not the customer base for a lot of Napa wines. And I know there's a lot of like concern, like, how are we gonna get the millennials? And it's like, well,
yeah.
you know, they're out there drinking wine. When I was in my, you know, 20s and early 20s and mid 20s, like I said, I was drinking Australian wines. I was drinking wines that were more affordable that I thought delivered a lot of quality for the price.
Yeah.
And, you know, now that I've, you know, been, you know, been doing well and working, I can afford to buy a little bit more nicer wine, but I'm still, you know, I'm not buying hundreds and hundreds of dollar bottles. You know what I mean? Like it's the stuff I like to collect is the stuff that if I buy 2 or 3 bottles a year, I'll give you an example, you know, something from the Priorat. I'll buy a bottle of like Clos Mogador every year.
Nice.
And I mean, that's an $80 bottle of wine. That's an expensive bottle of wine.
Yeah.
But like I'll buy the new release every year and I'll hang on to that. And maybe one day I'll be able to buy a case of that or, you know, I don't know. But I think that that's the baby steps that the millennials will eventually take when they get to the point where they have disposable income, where they can
yeah.
buy more wine. I mean, I think the ultimate goal is to make sure or to engage them at some level so that when they do get to that point, when they are, let's say, in their 40s or 50s, yeah, and they are buying more expensive wine, they remember Cliff Lady Vineyards makes great wine. I remember I tasted there, or I met, you know, Jason Lady or one of their representatives at a wine event, and I love the wines and I couldn't afford them then. But now, you know, that's what you want to do. You want to create that trust, yes, and that relationship that eventually will hopefully, you know, create a stronger bond between you and your customer. So I wouldn't say we're actively trying to like target that demographic. Like, yeah, you know, we just try to make great wine, and we believe that whether you're, you know, 21 or 81, if you just like to drink good wine and if you can afford one of our wines, you'll probably enjoy it. You know, it's well-made wine. So
again,
yeah, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, you're describing a long-term strategy. I don't know if it's a deliberate strategy or just permeates the fabric of your culture here. Mm-hmm. But what you're describing is investing in people.
Yeah.
And not necessarily expecting an immediate return.
Exactly.
And I think that in that of itself is a very healthy way of looking at things. And you've conducted yourself as a brand from the inception with a vision, mm-hmm, and then you executed on it. And you're doing essentially the same thing vis-a-vis the consumer. You're giving them value, you're giving them experience, mm-hmm, you're giving them delicious wines. But you don't have this expectation that you'll have a ready-made audience, you know, that's happening with respect to that age group. Mm-hmm. You know, that's unfortunate that it gets lost in conversations, that millennials just happen to be a different age. Mm-hmm. They just, like, you know, they have better technology.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, it's human values. Mm-hmm. You know, we all respond to the same stimuli. We want to feel good.
Yeah, right.
So let's focus on that. How do we improve that?
Yeah.
You treat your mailing list folks very well, mm-hmm, I hear. You have wonderful facility here. You have all kinds of events. So it definitely pays to be a member, mm-hmm, doesn't it?
Something we're constantly challenging ourselves to do, you know, more and better with.
Yeah.
You know, it's give people more and, build that connection to what we do and what we believe in. And so we're very fortunate that we have some great fans, and we just keep trying to give them more, like I say.
Yeah, no, the parties here are some of the best.
I can
attest to that.
Oh yeah, we like to have a good time.
And you're a DJ. You mentioned that, yeah, earlier, uh-huh, that you obviously inherited your dad's love of music.
Absolutely love music. Love classic rock, but yeah love hip hop too. So yeah, I DJ. I do events around town, or, you know, the funny thing was, it's always been a hobby of mine, and then just recently, over the last few years, I've done more of the events here at the winery. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we'd have trade people come sometimes and things like that. And people started hearing about it, like, oh, Jay Lady can come and play music for you. And it got to the point where I was getting asked by, you know, local restaurants and places,
nice,
to say, like, hey, we were looking to do featured DJ nights. Would you want to come in? And I thought it was great. I thought it was a good idea. And, you know, I got to the point where, like, well, okay, well, this is what we're going to pay you. Yeah. And this is what, you know, when we want you to come. And I just thought, you know, I feel weird, like, getting paid for something like that. That's something that I love to do. And that I feel is just a fun sort of service for the community at the same time, right? Like, improving the nightlife in Napa, as we know, sometimes can use some improvement. So things like that. And so what I decided to do was, to instead of accept payment, was to sort of encourage charitable contributions. So, mm-hmm, that's what I do now, is I say, okay, if you want me to come play, I'll come play, but we're gonna, you know, be accepting donations to, we've done like Mentis, we did Meals on Wheels just recently, we did Toys for Tots last year just before Christmas. So I always try to pick a cause before an event and then say, all right, anybody who's coming, if you wanna make a contribution, great. And then the venue that, you know, enlist my services, they usually make a larger contribution, whatever they would typically pay for their entertainment that night. So it's a nice way to raise money, to have fun, to get people to come out, and it's lower pressure that way too. I kind of am like, you know what, I do the events when they work and when they fit with what I got to do, because, you know, I have to sell wine, I have to travel, I'm not always around. So It is, I'm not looking at it to become like a second career. It's more just for fun.
How impressive. I'm sure your grandma, she's looking down, she's very proud. Because talk about it, feel good that you could save the funds for an extra bottle of Clomagador.
But yeah, right.
You choose something else. Yeah. You choose to serve the community, which is extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, it's like I say, it's something that I've learned from my grandmother and from my dad. He's, you know, he's very philanthropic. He's always out supporting the charity events here in Napa, and it's how you develop people's trust in you and what you're doing, and helping people out is something that we've always wanted to do. So, you know, it's important to us to, it's important for our people, for, it's important for us to help out because we are fortunate, and it's important, you know, for us, for people to trust us. That's the other part of it.
You literally are the future of the brand, and how fortunate, because you hear of brands being sold because, you know, it's not a given that people in the family want to continue the legacy that the kids are interested
in. Yeah.
It's just, you can't script it. It's not a perfect scenario. In your case, you're in, you're fully invested. How do you see the future of the brand? What would you like to happen in the near and long-term future?
Oh, that's a heavy question. I mean, I think, you know, we think a lot about long-term and what we want to do. And I think, you know, brand by brand, there's different sort of visions. You know, I think Cliff Lady, it's just continuing to make wines again that are just iconic, true to where they're from, and providing that experience for people when they come here, a really fun, engaging experience. We want people to leave and be like, that's my favorite winery. Maybe it wasn't their favorite wine necessarily, because maybe they like Zinfandel. We don't make Zinfandel. But their favorite winery to go to was Cliff Lady, because we had great wine and we had a great experience. So continuing that is probably the main vision there. I think, you know, from a operations standpoint and a business standpoint, I think finding more sources of vineyard that we can control is a vision that we also have. We made an investment towards the end of last year in a vineyard down in Carneros, where we're very confident we'll be able to grow some wonderful Sauvignon Blanc. And so instead of buying all the fruit for our Sauvignon Blanc and putting ourselves at risk to potentially losing vineyard sources, you know, let's go and do it ourselves, and let's make some wonderful wine from more estate vineyards. So I think that's maybe a more medium term, but I think that is a vision that we want to carry, you know, through the future. Is if we are buying fruit, if there is an opportunity to invest in that land or acquire land somewhere else and make an investment so that we can secure our future, I think that's another, you know, thing that we look at a lot. I think with Fell Wines, you know, it's continuing to just get that brand out there. It's still a very new brand. Not a lot of people know about it. So it's, you know, at least the short-term vision is just making sure that the wines are getting into the right places and that people are tasting them. And then, you know, long term, maybe there's a, you know, possibility of picking up different vineyards in the Anderson Valley and really having more estate property up there and making more wonderful single vineyard wines from those estates. But you know, ultimately it's just carrying forward that vision of, again, that sort of like staying true to where we're from, true to the vintage, and being not chasing trends. I think that's something that's gonna carry us forward. I mean, eventually, you know, I have a child on the way coming next year. Thank you. And, you know, eventually it'd be great if, you know, if they're interested, it would be great for them to have something that has, you know, a great reputation and can build upon that. Maybe there's more ability to then look outside of California. I mean, just recently we made an investment in a winery. I mentioned the Priorat, and I didn't mention the winery, but I do love Clomagador, but Mazdeutsch is a winery that we've partnered with in the Priorat region. And, you know, it was just a situation where we met a group of guys that making incredible wines, were looking for a partner to help them grow and help them improve the quality of their wines. And everything philosophically just gelled so perfectly that, you know, next thing we knew, we were 50% owners of a winery in the Priorat. So it's things like that, it's opportunities like that, that I think we will continue to look at. I think we've become more and more of a wine family, a winemaking family, and that doesn't just mean Napa Valley or Anderson Valley or California. It could be international too. So I think we'll continue to look at more things like that into the future. I think, I mean, long term, it'd be amazing for, you know, the name Lady to be synonymous with any of the great winemaking families that have done such a great job here in California or in Bordeaux or anywhere in the world, you know, and just getting to the point where it's like, if it says lady on it, it's going to be a great wine. And it could be, yeah, could be from Bordeaux. It could be from Spain. It could be from Australia. Who knows? Maybe we'll go back to Australia. But I think that that's what excites me, because I am such a lover of all the wines in the world. It doesn't matter what it is. I love everything. And it would be cool to, you know, make wine everywhere, right? It might be impossible. Maybe not impossible, but pretty damn hard. So we'll see. I think maybe one day.
That's fantastic. I can hear the excitement in your voice, and I know the listeners can too. And it's so reassuring in some ways. It's almost like an insurance policy from the consumer's point of view, what you just said, that every bottle of wine that you pick up that has your name on it has integrity.
Right.
And the fact that you're so invested and it's generational, you know, you're here to stay. This is your life's work. It's your passion.
Yep.
That is, you know, in so many, it's a beautiful thing, but in so many ways from the practical standpoint, you know, again, honors where you are and honors the end user, people that consume your product and will do so. It's just one of those, in today's chaotic world, one of those reassurances that I think we all could use. And again, to highlight, if you come here, you will feel really good about yourself, about your experience, about the wine. You know, there's not even a whiff of pomp and circumstance at all. It's all about humility. It's all about dedication. And it's such a pleasure to be here. And it's been fantastic speaking with you today. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you and to, you know, tell your listeners a little bit more about Lady Family Wines and what we're trying to accomplish. And it's been a great conversation and wonderful to taste the wines with you. And I love your perspective on the wines and how you've been able to taste them over the years and see the continuation. And I really appreciate your time too. So thank you.
You're more than welcome.
Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure featuring Ilona Thompson. We'll see you again next week.